Father, you mentioned compassion overload, and certainly this is a major problem for anyone in the priesthood, or this is a major problem for anyone in the priesthood of the ministry who's offering compassion to everyone in their communities. But I think in general for Christians, this is a, you know, anyone who's taking the Christian life seriously is going to have this problem as well. Could you give us some practical ways? You know, you talked about taking a retreat with your wife and whatnot, but you know, we don't always have the 2 weeks or the funds to do those sorts of things. What are some kind of practical things on a daily basis that we can do to recharge?
I've been asked to have you introduce yourself also, please.
Hello, my name is Michael. I attend Elevation of the Holy Cross Parish, OCA, in Sacramento, California. I'm here at the kind request of my dear friend, Father John Christensen, with the blessing of His Grace, Saint Joseph.
So your question, and I'm not sure if we should be repeating questions for the sake of that. Yeah. So if I'm understanding your question well, you're asking about things that you can do with the inevitability, I guess would be a word for compassion fatigue to happen in the course of our ministry. Yes? Okay. And I think it's important that, just as you said, I'll use the example of exercise. We're going to see if we can have the audiovisual for later sessions. I can put some slides for developing life goals as well as dealing with compassion fatigue. But I think a very first step that we need to do is that we can't say, we have to stop saying we do it all the time. We have to stop saying, I don't have the time. We have to make the time. When I applied for a hospital chaplaincy job, I was asked what my life rule consisted of. I had to think long and hard. The one aspect of a life rule beside prayer that I could speak to was that I exercise. I had the blessing and the curse, which I'll speak to both sides, of being on the beach in Far Rockaway, New York. I literally would go out of my office from the hospital several times a week and take my lunch break and go for a run on the beach with the ocean water and the breeze and the sun and just have that little renewal. And my boss used to yell at me because I wouldn't take my phone, I didn't take my keys, I didn't take any identification. It was just a brief time to check out. And so my wife, as I would go running, and my boss, when I would go running, struggled with that a little bit. But I said to them, and that's what I'm wanting to say back to your question, is that we can't save these things for when we have time. We have to build it in. Otherwise, it's never going to happen. Not just prayer time, but exercise time. Not just exercise time, but time for creative work. Time to just be. Time to do something that is fulfilling for us. It is imperative that we make the time for this, because otherwise we become one of those dry potsherds. That when people come to us, we have nothing left to give. And it is a struggle, but we have to make that time. So whether it's a day, it doesn't have to be a week. That's one way we worked on solving it, because both of our lives have spun in very complex circles. We're coming up on 25 years this year. But we have to make the time somehow, some way, so that we don't fall into that trap. And I said blessing and curse from Long Island because I also was still at St. John's Hospital when Storm Sandy went through. You may recall, if you saw in the news, the homes that were burning during that hurricane was there. There was no electricity except for the partial generator of our hospital for weeks. So people started showing up for meals, for a place to stay, for medication. The staff who were treating them no longer had homes to go home to. And so talk about compassion fatigue setting in. I will offer you a resource to get some training in crisis ministry, a website that you can go to. It's ICISF.org, International Critical Incident Stress Foundation.org. And even if I'm being recorded, I will still say this. Before you undertake any other crisis ministry programs, go get this training, because they teach you all of the elements involved. Because one of the things about ministering in crisis, and many of us do this for long periods of time, is that we get into crisis mode, and it becomes impossible for us to step back from crisis mode. It was impossible for the people in that hospital. So where most crisis ministry takes place after the incident is over, we realize for the first time, and this whole field is changing rapidly today, but we realize for the first time that we needed to do something now. Our staff were coming apart at the seams. They were staying in their offices at night. And so we developed a little program, and like I said, I will see if we can get the audio visual up so we can show. Some of us are auditory learners, some are visual, and it's actually a good little presentation. But we hit on a way of giving people an opportunity to speak to what's going on, and the short form of it is to say, what have you been hearing? So if we were in the room and we had just faced a crisis, I could ask, what are you all feeling? And you would all be sitting as you are now, no hands raised. But by asking, what have you been hearing? Oh man, the hands went up. All kinds of things. We're struggling. We don't have anywhere to go. So all these things started coming out because of the anonymity factor. And then in like manner, what are you hearing people say? What are they feeling? Which is part of a critical incident stress response protocol. Again, I heard this and I heard this, and people, I saw somebody crying. So with that little anonymity factor, it opened the door for being able to talk about what was going on. So your question is a very appropriate question. We have to guard against that. Because unfortunately, and I also have to say this, just in hearing in short form, your diocese and your way of responding to clergy in need, and it sounds from what I heard that there are responses to clergy in need. I grew up in an area of the country and watched as clergy got to that point of no return, crossed over the border, something happened, and they are simply removed out of ministry, opportunity lost to salvage that priestly ministry or diaconal ministry or episcopal ministry. And so as a church, we also need to get much better. You all are doing that, which is just wonderful to hear. But we need to get better about supporting one another. We need to get better about listening to one another. And that presumes that we're talking to one another, so that as things come up, we can try to respond. That's just so critical. So making time and talking about what's going on in our own spiritual life. We have to be developing our own spiritual life, or we lose that path, that narrow path. And we have to make that a part of our commitment, that we need to keep growing and developing. Those are just essential pieces. And that's still not going to guarantee that we don't fall into compassion fatigue. But at least it provides some barriers and gives us some support in those times.
Father, two things.
Your name first, I'm asking.
Yes, George Aquaro. Torrance.
Not that I don't know you.
Yes. And by the way, thank you for all that you did for me when I was in seminary, because in the ICISF training, I actually went through at your recommendation, and all of my classmates thought that I was crazy. That's and I nothing has changed. But I graduated seminary in May of 2001, and a few months later 9/11 happened, and all the seminarians were sent down to Ground Zero, and one of my classmates called me later and said, "You should have been here. You were the only person who knew anything about what to do." And I was enjoying the sun in California. Two things. Number one is, if, and maybe you're going to talk about this in different areas, talking about how do you deal with depression? Because that seems to be the number one thing that I've struggled with, and I've heard a lot of my brethren struggling with. The other thing also is, and this has more to do with the family in particular, is because of the cell phone, I'm always at church, and I'm always dealing with church issues. And, you know, even though I have an office in my house, if you want to call it that, where I deal with this stuff, it's still happening in the midst of my family, or things happen in the parish, and my kids are watching it. And the other day, there are some people who just always seem to be an issue in a parish, and you're always dealing with their needs and their problems and whatnot, and their misbehaviors. And I've noticed that my kids have picked up on who these people are. And one time I got off the phone after one of these situations, and my daughter looks at me and goes, "Oh, that jerk again." And so how do you deal with the cynicism? Because that was another thing, is, you know, I've come across the children of priests, and they wanted nothing to do with the priesthood or anything else because they saw what happened to their fathers. They saw what happened to their families. So how do you keep the because there's a lot of upsides to what we do, but unfortunately, you know, a lot of times that upside stuff we have to keep confidential. We can't talk about somebody's victories and the positive things that go on, but man, the negative stuff, it's right there for everybody to see. So if you could address that, I would appreciate it. Thank you.
So as I was listening to your question, it had several parts to it. The nonstop nature of parish life as it flows through our lives, dealing with depression and also dealing with cynicism. It strikes me, and for those, I know we're at a point of a divide. I remember the households that had a phone that if you weren't home to answer it, you didn't get a call. Now that we have cell phones, we go crazy to answer the very next second. My wife and I go back and forth with this also. It's kind of funny, actually, the turns in life, and that's something we realized later, I think, in ministry too. My wife was the marketing person, and I was the one who worked in institutional settings. Now, 25 years later, I'm fundraising for the seminary, and my wife is managing an urgent care. And so because of that, she is on her phone all the time. If a staff member calls, if this happens, if that happens. So it's not just me in parish life or ministry, but it's her with her work. So we can magnify that portrayal by saying that our life, our home life and our work life have gotten so inextricably mixed that we have a hard time separating them anymore. And it would be my thesis in that we have to try to maintain some separation. There's a good little book by a rabbi, The Sabbath Day. It's writing about taking a Sabbath. We need to reclaim what Sabbath means in our life. We need to appoint times that are Sabbath-oriented, rest, recovery, recuperation. We have to do this. Because if we don't, the end game is really cynicism. And once that cynicism gets entrenched, then we're no longer alive spiritually to be with anyone else. We're just looking through the lens of that darkness at really everything around us. So we need to do our very best to get support and to actively work to stay on this side of that cynical cliff. Because once we go over it, it's very hard to get back. And I think you and I probably all have witnessed someone somewhere who went over that edge and is basically going through the motions of ministry, celebrating services, whatever it is. And we have to draw back from there, as hard an effort as that is. So that needs to be something we hold out on the horizon. And when we're getting close, we need to step up what we need to do. The recovery process has a really good way of talking about that. They talk about higher levels of care. So if you're not getting what you need in an outpatient setting, you might have to go to an inpatient setting. And by the way, I'll do a brief commercial on that while I'm here. I think I have the book here. Yeah. This is one of the best books I read in recent times. It's called The Spirituality of Imperfection. Perhaps some of you had seen it. It kind of tells a story for me that I didn't put the pieces together for many years. When I was in seminary, Father Hopko was talking about recovery. And I never understood what was driving that, whether it was someone in the family or whether it was a topic that he had taken a personal interest in. But this book was written around the early 1990s. Father Tom is quoted, as are many others. It brings stories from the Jewish tradition, the Christian tradition, and many others. But the gist of the story is that the recovery movement itself inadvertently tripped on the long spiritual history of the Jewish and Christian traditions. And some have tried to make that more emphatic, but the book here is simply making the point that by having people come to a room and be together has a profound effect. And I've said this many times, if I were to be able to choose a congregation to be a pastor of, I'd want to choose people in recovery. Why? Because they know it's life and death, that if they don't get it right, they may not get another chance. And so often in parish life, we kind of keep that cloud that, yes, I'm a Christian and I try to be as devout as I can, and yet I can look at my neighbor and pass judgment and all the rest. But for the recovering person, they know they've got to put every bit of time and energy into it. So maybe as an exercise, I would encourage you to do this. Go to an open meeting and just listen. It has a profound way of reorganizing what's important in our life, as does serious illness, as does other things. But do we have to wait until those happen before we take this seriously? And that's really the question. So talking with people who know that this is life and death helps us to take all this much more seriously. That we only get one opportunity with our families. We only get one opportunity with our parish faithful. And so we need to do the very best that we can with them. Regarding your third focus of depression, that's a particularly difficult dimension to work with in parish life, because it makes us even more vulnerable to the burdens that are around us. Some say depression is anger turned inward. So if we have strong feelings and we don't have an opportunity to give expression to them, they get turned inward and we get slowed down. I'm here to offer a witness, and I'll try to do this in a quiet and respectful way, but it was so profound. We have a student at the seminary who has been struggling with depression and had a particularly difficult time in the course of a particular semester. And lo and behold, when it came time to do a presentation, that same student talked about their experience of depression. So every student in that room learned something profound about what the depressed person's experience is, not from a book, not from a lecture, but experientially. It was one of the most profound times I've had to date of being in a classroom setting, of his being that vulnerable to talk about that experience and his struggle with it as a help for his classmates to not pass judgment on a depressed person any more than we pass judgment on someone who is in recovery, as is so easy for us to do, to say, well, if they only really tried hard, they could kick it. That's our kind of cognitive response to recovery. It's not. There's more to it. There's a chemical dimension to it. And so he offered a powerful witness. So when we are dealing with illness of a psychiatric nature, it's really no different than dealing with a medical condition. We need to go and seek treatment so that we can be as healthy as we are able to be. And while we're doing that, to continue to be in dialogue with our spiritual confessor, the person that we entrust our spiritual life to walk side by side. So to say another way, as pastors, if a parishioner comes and says, Father, I just wanted to let you know that I'm dealing with depression and this is what I'm doing right now, is not to refer as in go talk to someone, but rather, I will walk with you as you go through this treatment process and be an active participant. Listen, ask them about their experience. Let them share that with you so that now we are joining the spiritual and the psychological. And it's interesting that in conversation with this same student, wanting very much to find a way of connecting the spiritual reality and the psychological reality rather than dividing them and saying we're going to work here or we're going to work there, but really wanting to look at this experience. And one of the gifts that wound up happening is I shared with him the story of one of the founders of the clinical pastoral education movement. His name was Anton Boyson. And for any of you who have taken CPE, you might have learned something about Boyson. He was a pastor, and he suffered several psychotic episodes in his life. His perspective with respect to those episodes was that they were efforts to reach a greater spiritual life. So he saw his psychiatric illness through the lens of spiritual wholeness and desiring to reach greater spiritual wholeness. And that story spoke to this student in a very strong way, because it is said that if Anton Boyson ever went to this organization for certification, that he would never have been certified. And yet because of that, and I want to reference His Eminence's comment this morning after Matins, it is Anton Boyson who also created the frame of studying the living human document. You said that this morning, that we can gain something from each and every one of us, from each other. And his focus was, if we're going to study scripture, the patristic writings, and all the other documents of the church, should we not take that same level of care in addressing a living human document, another person? And so whatever the struggle is that our parishioners are going through or we ourselves are going through, being able to listen, being able to talk about that experience is a very important part of it being embraced as a part of our spiritual life. Final quick comment, and then we'll ask for any other questions. James Hillman wrote a book, The Soul's Code, a wonderful book. He's talking about growing down into oneself. But he, I saw him at a conference once, and he talked about this, and I'll make this my final comment on that question. He said, you know, when we get sick, we imagine what getting well is like. And getting well means, for many of us, going back to our pre-sickness state. And he said, no, that's all wrong. Getting well is learning how to live with the experience of sickness and brokenness. So for us as pastors, and I meant to bring this up in my presentation, so I'll make a quick comment now, or that'll come up later on in our next session. But it is that same brokenness that we struggle with that in so many ways informs our ministry. Or when you and I struggle in a certain way in our spiritual life, I've certainly seen this, that on so many occasions, before too long, someone comes to me with an issue that's of a similar nature. And I've come to see that as God's hand preparing me. So when I'm going through difficulties, yes, I'm struggling, everyone does, but I'm also thinking about, oh my, I'm going through this right now. What's going to be happening down the road? Will this in some way become a dimension of ministry and time to someone else? So we need to be attentive to what's going on in our life as pastors if we're going to have any hope of being with our faithful as they're struggling. And same thing for our bishops in tending to the clergy as they are in those parish communities. We need to be alive to this experience so that we can join with others in theirs. And that's where we draw back from that cynicism. It keeps all of it alive, our spiritual life and the life of those that we're called to minister to. So.
Hi, Father. My name is Father Paul Baba of West Sacramento. I had a parishioner a while ago who said to me, Father, if it wasn't for Orthodoxy and the Holy Fathers, and I would just go nuts. And I said, I remember saying to him, oh, all of us would be going nuts. He goes, no, Father, I seriously would have been going nuts. And I went, ooh. And is that the answer we can give one who has depression, in your view? Would it be a strong answer if we say to them, the Lord is my strength, I love the Lord my strength, my refuge, my deliverer? Is that something that they're lacking mostly that makes them depressed because they find themselves empty in life, they haven't responded to spiritual life, they're walking outside the path to salvation, maybe their household, their parents, Lord have mercy on the parents, when they argue, the kids never see them going to an icon corner to find peace, or they don't see them bringing up them in the faith, yet they give to us priests on Sunday, you know, oh yes, Father, teach my kids well. I don't want them to take drugs and marry some good-looking Mormon out there or whatever it is. They give us so much. When in the household, as a priest, when we go to bless their homes, we see that the households are failing spiritually speaking. So would you say that because the fact that they were brought up, these kids, in such emptiness in Christ, that they need above anything else, I will love thee, I will love the Lord with all my heart, and the Lord is my strength, my refuge, and my deliverer?
Yeah, so the question is about ministering to depressed people and offering supportive, whether scriptural passages or brief references as you identified them. It would be my sense that ministering to the depressed person is one of the most challenging forms of ministry because we all want to help. We want to help. And when the depressed person comes to us or we encounter the depressed person, we experience a sense of the kind of the vacuum where things have slowed down, processing has slowed down, a sense of, you know, pessimism over day-to-day life. And so it evokes in us a desire to reach out and to embrace and to give all of these resources. So my word to you would be one of caution. Sometimes it's helpful to have a very short phrase to work on, but as our student was sharing in class, to be given a book to read, or a passage to study, or a scriptural passage to be inspired by, it's almost impossible for them to focus on that. And so it winds up placing us at a distance from them. And so we have to be careful when we're trying to reach out to minister to the depressed person. My response to you would be sure that we can give some and say that this is a meaningful passage for me and share it that way. But much more what I want to do is I want to listen. I want to validate the experience that they're going through with them as someone else who is in that dark space with them, looking for the light with them, which is different from bringing the light to them. We're walking with them, searching for Christ's light in the midst of that darkness. And they will experience us being that light. Not that we're calling attention and carrying a candle before them, but because they see us desiring to journey with them. And it will have that meaning. So my encouragement, both to you and to Father George, is being a listening presence, especially in the midst of depression, is very, very valuable. Maybe mixed with some things, I would cast them as expressions, scriptural passages that are meaningful to me when I struggle. Then it's coming to them relationally, not prescriptively. And there's a big difference. Other questions or comments? Really good questions this morning.
I'm Father Andrew from Ben Lomond. Not a question, just a comment. I had some surgery several years ago, and I had opiates for several weeks afterwards. And oh my gosh, the damage it did to me, but the empathy it gave to me for others that I minister to, that I never took drugs in my life. And then I took this stuff, and I was in a fetal position crying every night. And my wife would say, why don't you sing a psalm? Why don't you pray? And I said, I can't. I can't even find the index card to prayer or the catalog for joy in my heart. I'm dying inside. So to experience that was phenomenal for me. I sure don't ever want to do it again. But It certainly opens my empathy towards those in my parish that have had that drug experience. So, it was hellish, but it was very good for me.
Well, very powerful witness of going to have surgery and then being given painkillers of a opiate quality that have an addictive quality and the impact that that can have. You remind me of ministry and counseling to a young lady when I was pursuing my counseling degree that to this day, I have an audio recording of it, of the session. So just to frame it for a brief moment, I can't draw to save my life, okay? And as we were going through the counseling program, they were saying you should try other modalities beside talk therapy. So that was planted in my mind. But I can't draw to save my life, so why would I ask anyone else to do this, right? So I had this woman come into counseling. She suffered from fibromyalgia. She had severe back pain and other things. And so she was on those Vicodin lollipops and all those things. So she would come in, and she would literally look like she was intoxicated. And most of the staff members were convinced that she was simply abusing her medication and that no good was going to come from counseling. But in the back of my mind, I remembered, try another modality. So after session after session, when she would pour out how difficult her life was and how she couldn't function, do really anything, that one day I came armed with paper and pens. And I said, while we're talking, I'd like to ask you to try something. I have some paper and pens. Could you draw a little while we talk? Oh, no, 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 I couldn't do that. And I insisted, again, remembering I couldn't do this. And so she started drawing as she talked. And the most amazing thing happened. While she was drawing, she talked about her cats. She talked about her ceramic work that she had done and received awards for. She talked about the joys in her life. And the drawing that she did was a perfect drawing of nature with flowers and trees. And so I witnessed, maybe for the first time from a neurological perspective, our left and right brains. Drawing uses the right brain instead of the left, where we do all the cognitive processing. And when she was able to go into that right brain through her drawing, it brought out a whole nother dimension that I had never seen. And so, and I have an audio tape of the session, of what was happening when we started and what was happening as she was drawing, and it was a most phenomenal experience. So you're right, in the midst of that recovery process, it's almost impossible, and we get to see just what people experience, but firsthand, and it makes it different, doesn't it? We're no longer then looking and saying, oh, you know, if only, or you could be different. But now we experience how difficult it is to come back from these places. And it changes our pastoral approach, I hope, to be one more of compassionate and mercy. We're going to talk about that when next we come together to look at the priest and his parish. So thank you for that.